Audiobook test on the old book. The Hidden Teaching Beyond Yoga by Paul Brunton, PhD. Most footnotes are not included here, see other formats of book then. Some numbers read here can be anything. This is only made for myself to get an overview of this book. Chapter 1. Beyond Yoga. The more I wander around this turning globe, the more I realize that it is not only individual men, parties, governments or peoples who are to blame for the distressful condition of the human race, so mesmerized by popular follies and so deluded by traditional fables exclamation mark, but also common ignorance concerning three fundamental questions. What is the meaning of the world and experience? What am I? What is the object of existence? I perceive with startling precision that the bursting of this integument of ancient ignorance will do more than anything else to make enduring peace descend on our troubled earth. The pith of the world problem is too plain for our complex age to perceive. All acts are sprayed up by the hidden fountain of mind, and when men learn to think rightly they will act accordingly, not before. Their deeds can never be greater than their ideas, for the unheard declarations of the mind decide the noisy journeys of the feet. The world's bitter sorrows and bestial sins are but symptoms of a disease whose cause is old ignorance and whose only cure is new knowledge. It is the inescapable duty of every intelligent rational human being, troubled by half-conscious and inchoate yearnings for a better life, not to rest in mental sloth but to persist in searching for the answers to these three questions, that is, for the scintillating asterism of truth. It is a commonplace remark that we live today in an unparalleled world situation. We are born at a crucial juncture in recorded history. Certain new currents of thought, feeling and activity have been strongly stirring the whole globe since this century opened, and less so for a few centuries earlier. The war has but brought them to a fuller and dramatic convulsion. The slow chronicle of former epochs fades into petty insignificance when compared with our own. The sightless multitudes stand bewildered before its iconoclastic changes and staggered before its devastating events. Mars has put this planet on the torture rack. Nemesis has moved among the nations like a judge, putting on the grim periwig and sternly holding the forgotten scales. And all peoples wander blindly through one of the most momentous transitions which time has ever imposed on the race. Seven new transforming features of our time are most remarkable from the standpoint of the philosopher, however, and possess an ultimate bearing on the publication of this book. The first noteworthy feature is the incredible development of mechanical transport between villages, towns, countries and continents, through the use of steam and electric trains, petrol-driven automobiles, omnibuses, steamships and aeroplanes. Thus the planet has shrunk and mankind has been involuntarily drawn together. This has definitely widened the space sense of millions of people. It has brought them into personal contact with their own neighbors, with strangers and foreigners, hence we witness a resulting interchange of racial cultures, a multiplication of ideas and an expansion of outlooks. Something has thus happened to the world which has no recorded equivalent. Ideas can no longer be insulated, except under the pressure of brute force, and then only for a limited time. And one unrated consequence has been that the voice of Asiatic wisdom is now being heard by European and American ears. The second feature is the phenomenal raising of both the political status and the economic standard of living of the working classes, when compared with two or three generations ago. This has unfolded within them a sense of self-respect which they lacked when they were tied with the bonds of inherited serfdom. Aristos has handed his scepter to Demos, unwillingly no doubt, and Demos is wielding it considerately but uncertainly or dictatorially and decisively. He worships multitudes and abases himself before magnitude. The crowd carries the day, its verdict is the last word. But the brighter consequence of this unprecedented emancipation has in turn been the unfoldment of an interest in life beyond the unavoidable grind of earning a livelihood. The masses have begun to look beyond their noses and to free themselves from a parochial outlook. The larger questions and arguable issues of religion, politics and culture are no longer entirely outside their range. The third feature is the elimination of illiteracy and the democratization of education. Knowledge is no longer the monopoly of a fortunate few. Free and compulsory education has worked marvelous changes within a single century in the mind of those who were formerly treated as children by despotic ruling classes. The educational tide has flowed with increasing pressure throughout the world, with the consequence that the masses are far less unsophisticated today than they once were. They have outgrown to a marked extent beyond yoga the kindergarten doctrines with which they were fed. The setting up of the first few letter types sounded the throwing down of all the old epochs of gross ignorance. Whether European peasant or workman of 1,000 years ago was unable to read a letter and could not even sign his name, the European and American peasant or workman of today can not only read all the letters of the alphabet but also write them. Nor is this progress confined to those continents, although it has reached its crescendo there. Asia and Africa are on the move, too. But we must not fall into the superficial assumption that this has greatly helped man's capacity to think rightly. Education is of two kinds: that which merely diffuses facts and helps men to memorize them, and that which helps them to think rightly about those facts. Most education belongs to the first category, which depends on the use of intellect only, but some belongs to the second, which depends on the higher faculty of reason. However, the general increase in the area of knowledge does lead to some increase in the area of inquiry, and this in turn to a consequent if still smaller rational awakening. People are now more ready to apply reason to life than they formerly were, although they are not ready enough to make such an application play a vital part in their existence. Therefore, it may reasonably be hoped that many more neophytes will seek for philosophical initiation when its deep and difficult tenets are freed from their opaque veil of forbidding phraseology and put into more lucid words. The fourth feature is the list of striking inventions to improve communication which have succeeded each other ever since Gutenberg printed the first black-lettered word on white paper in Germany and William Caxton set up a creaking hand press in London. The printing press, the cheap post, the electric telegraph, the telephone, the cinema and wireless transmission are civilizing instruments which have combined to communalize and popularize knowledge and make it swiftly available to all. The consequence has been that a continuous interchange of facts, thoughts, ideas and views is proceeding everywhere. Time has lapsed into little account when wireless and cable can combine to bring the entire planet's news to one's house in a flash, when newspapers or printed periodicals place a description of today's scientific discovery in England before the eyes of a reader in China the same week. A man broadcasting in London will hear the echo of his voice in 1/7th of a second, during which flash it has traveled the globe and penetrated the ears of innumerable listeners. Thus these inventions have also succeeded in altering and expanding the time sense of most people. Moreover, the opening up for study of immense evolutionary periods in the past history of man and universe has begun to accustom the educated to think in terms of tremendous time vistas. The old-fashioned sense of time as being a slow-moving thing has gone with the wind of progress. We live now in a moving world, not a static one. The tempo of American life has altered to a rate undreamt of by Inca or Aztec. The domestic arrangements and mechanisms of European households allow for numerous daily activities never contemplated in the program of leisurely old Romans. The habits of 100 generations are disintegrating before our eyes, but those who spend their whole lives in Occidental cities may not note and appreciate this astonishing alteration so much as those who sojourn at times in Oriental villages where days may be passed remote from all signs of our science and our time. The evolution of men's minds is therefore much more rapid than in earlier centuries. The newspaper, produced at the rate of 20,000 per hour, has become a great formative force in modern life. Where the medieval man could not procure a single book to read because of its high cost and great rarity, his present-day descendant can now procure a newspaper every day and read a cheap new book every week. The printed sheet has spread knowledge, prepared the way for science, publicly proclaimed it in every modern language, and may now clear a new if narrower path for philosophy in general. The birth of the printing press signaled the death of all the eras of esotericism. The time has come to open more fully for the Western world the little visited track of a hidden Oriental philosophy. The fifth feature is the appearance of science on the intellectual horizon of mankind. For good or for worse, it has affected the mind of today. Its birth in Europe ushered in the era of fact and compelled the world to begin to bid adieu to the era of fable. Men are rising from the primitive rule of magic to the maturer rule of logic. The growth of human mentality may not be very great, but it is clearly noticeable and it is antagonistic to human superstition. The rise of the one means the fall of the other. Scientific facts were once nervous intruders into the forum where guesswork flourished, but today they dominate the world scene. Bacon was but a precursor of the Darwinian war of reason teachings against dogmatic beliefs which left such a deep mark on the thought of the last century. Whatever may have been the place of blind faith during former centuries, it cannot again for long assume leadership in a century when reason has so visibly beyond yoga and so tangibly shown its triumphs all around us. We have begun to grow up, and the jejune chatterings of primitive minds will sooner or later annoy our ears. The achievements of science are the inseparable facts of our day. Its marvels fill our homes, throng our streets, float on the five oceans and move invisibly through space. Thus they have decisively demonstrated to the whole world the superior value of applied reason. The advent of new scientific knowledge published to the whole world has begun to shift the foundations of human life, to affect the spirit of our time and to alter our outlook. Every man who faithfully follows its discoveries has had to make a fresh appraisal of all existence, including his own. The historic moment of the modern scientific era's arisal really began when Galileo broke away from the stronghold of tradition and performed his famous experiment in the Leaning Tower of Pisa. It was the beginning of a vast series of worldwide researches which culminated in the scientific picture of the world as a huge, causally governed automatic machine. God as fussy creator, as capricious supervisor and arbitrary judge, was conveniently dropped out of the old medieval picture. This was the first revolution in the Western outlook. The second came when Röntgen discovered the electrical basis of the atom. Research moved still more rapidly, so rapidly, in fact, that the scientists are now again repainting their picture. The universe is no longer a machine. What it has now become, nobody knows for certain. The new picture is blurred and vague, even amorphous. But this is because it belongs to the domain of philosophy. For there has been a gradual process of abstraction, a transition from the empiric standpoint to the metaphysical, a growing tendency for science to become part of its own field of investigation and to turn matter and mechanism into concepts. All signs now indicate that science is not merely shaking hands with philosophy, but that Mercury is even preparing to marry Minerva. What is of special interest is that science is also unwittingly moving into the camp of the hidden philosophy, for some of its latest tenets as formulated by Einstein, Planck, Heisenberg, genes and others were anticipated and affirmed by the Indian sages at a time when Western civilization was babbling in its infancy. For the first time in history it is possible to formulate the products of Eastern thought in Western terms, that is to say, in scientific terms, and to synthesize them with the rich results of Western researches. Europe and America have furnished new and broader foundations for the Asiatic wisdom. The latter can now be expounded with an amplitude which has never before been voiced. Thus ancient sage and modern scientist unconsciously meet, and it is now possible to construct a tremendously significant intellectual synthesis, a universal ideology of truth which could not have been possible before. The sixth feature is the comparatively increased leisure which has been made available for people of all classes, but especially of the working classes, through the applications of machinery to every department of human existence, consequent on the Industrial Revolution. It is customary for the moderns to complain of lack of leisure, but the truth is that the caveman had far less. He had to fight inclement nature, uncontrolled man and ravenous beast. He had to fight for his sheer existence, food and satisfaction. It was, therefore, possible for man to turn to think of higher things only after he had sufficiently conquered these wants. When in all history has man achieved such an overwhelming conquest as today? He has more time to undermine his own ignorance. Therefore, if a few men could study philosophy in ancient times, the extended leisure of today renders the hour ripe for more students who are willing to use their leisure wisely to be attracted to its illustrious tutelage. The seventh feature is the historical fact that post-war periods generate religious doubts in many minds, with the consequent search for a more acceptable explanation of life in some of these minds. But when two wars have been waged within a single generation, when they are the worst which the world has ever seen, and when they have spread on the most gigantic scale history has ever known, it is undoubtedly no error to predict that faith will sink seriously after the shock of the cataclysm. The despairing feeling that life is without a purpose will spread through all classes of people. The power of religion to control men ethically is likely to be much weakened, which will constitute a position of profound social danger. The breaking down of these old sanctions amid unrest and upheaval demands their reinforcement or replacement by new ones. For most men cannot live in comfort with the thought that there is no fundamental meaning and no great purpose in life. They will soon seek out some faith or theory that will bestow direction to existence. Therefore, the present convulsed and collapsed epoch will witness a search for such doctrines as no previous epoch has yet witnessed. And because these changes will always be most marked among the more educated classes, the forms which this quest is likely to take will be mainly mystical and occasionally philosophical rather than religious. Mysticism will probably receive a larger number of adherents than Beyond Yoga. It has known for a long time, for it offers an emotional inner peace urgently needed after the maniacal frenzies and horrors of war, but philosophy will also have to welcome within its portals a modest modicum of new inquirers who have changed their intellectual gear. If these seven factors mean anything at all, they mean that history is in the throes of turning its sharpest corner, that the cultural growth of mankind has been notably accelerated, that a new and unique epoch in human knowledge is opening before the educated world, that the potential field of receptivity to the philosophy of truth is wider and deeper than ever before, that secrecy is becoming superfluous, and that for the first time a new worldwide propagation of higher views has been rendered possible. Moreover, the international political and economic conditions today are such as to force people everywhere to see events and things in their relation to the whole, that is to begin to philosophize. Nothing like this opportune phenomenon, which requires the utmost emphasis, can be found in centuries other than the 20th. This astonishing age of social transition, general dissolution, technological revolution and mental illumination is, in short, a continuous acceleration of the process of turning man from a primitive to a scientific animal. But even this is not enough. Man should live in the way that is proper to him, and not after the manner of the beast, the reptile and the parasite. Hence the time is ripe to disclose a doctrine which does not, like most religions, contradict the findings of science, but actually draws support from them. It is really advisable under such conditions to relax the ancient restrictions and release sufficient of the old genuinely Aryan knowledge to help the better cultured classes act more wisely, that something nobler may emerge and that we may all advance towards the shaping of a finer human world. For it is to them that the sheep-like masses must always look for guidance. It is their ways of thinking which are set up as criterions to be aimed at, and it is their ways of living which are held up for ambition or imitation. Progress flows from the top, from the leading circles and higher classes of every community, downwards until it permeates the populace. The ideas and beliefs held by the most educated and enlightened strata slowly come to be received by those below. Their outlook and attitude count most in influencing the world. Therefore it is to them particularly that the hidden philosophy is now addressed. The enthusiastic activities of European scientists can now be harmonized with the calm contemplations of Oriental sages. The butterfly of true integral wisdom can ere long burst forth from its cocoon, wherein it has matured and sheltered during the past. This union may presage the new East-West civilization which may one day arise when the spindle of time has spun far beyond our counting and the primacy of materialism has been deposed, and when truth may sit enthroned to direct the real renaissance of all human life and labor. The manhood of humanity must eventually arrive, and if this grand conception could spread among the educated classes of a warless world from Siberia to Spain, and from Colombo to California, the consequences would be remarkable. Unfortunately, the materialization of such a vision seems quite remote. It is indeed very far off. Nevertheless, the immense renovation which must follow the world's gigantic collapse will surely bring more candidates to the portals of philosophy in a quest of new roads, new knowledge and new axioms. Both the sufferings and knowledge of our times have united to act as a cataclysmic agent which must arouse a new orientation in the world mind. Not that the new is to be regarded as the better, but rather as having the opportunity to be better. Such are the reasons which render it advisable for this hoary old wisdom to emerge from its hiding place in the minds of a microscopically small number of Asiatics and become accessible to a wider if still limited circle. Its advent is clearly a product of historical necessity. No other all-comprehensive culture can fit so well into the recently expanded time and space sense of mankind. Who am I with this treatise? Therefore, I rise with my readers part of the way to such a higher view. The ascension will demand much from them, but it will give more, for it will, when completed in a further volume, finally solve all such problems, remove their deepest doubts and furnish them with an impregnable rock-like support throughout life. Moreover, the thoughtful scientist who cares to study these pages with a free mind may find the further clues he needs for progress towards the self-disclosure of reality. The devotee of religion who wishes to worship the living God rather than dead dogma may discover the secret mainspring of his own faith. The mystic may learn how to rise from his blissful thought of God, which is but an image, to the thoughtless and imageless God as he really is, whilst the philosopher whose brain is distracted by the diverse opinions which prevail everywhere may here meet with an attitude of mind which is finally infallible and can dispose of all criticism. For its roots stretch far back into primeval Asia, when Napoleons had arisen in the world of thought to unshackle themselves from hieratic addition and to force their passage through Alpian problems. Paradoxically yet inevitably this archaic culture must soon levy beyond yoga. Tribute from the adolescent young Western world. Even time itself can never antiquate the antiquity of such a culture. It is time conquering because it arises out of the ever-enduring reality within which the universe is embraced. I did not know, when I first landed on India's surf-sprayed shores, that I had embarked on a quest which would ultimately carry me even beyond the doctrines of mysticism and the practice of meditation itself, which for so long I had deemed the highest life open to man. I did not know, as I slowly but steadily penetrated to the inmost secrets of orthodox Indian yoga, that the enterprise of winning the truth about life would not only take me into and through its confines but also set me wandering again far beyond them. I did not know that I had thrown dice with destiny and that the game was not to be concluded in the manner I had been led to expect, that is, by settling down to an existence which made physical and mental withdrawnness in profound contemplation its highest goal and sublimest fulfillment. For the benefit of readers to whom the terms are unfamiliar, it must here be mentioned that yoga is a Sanskrit word which appertains to various techniques of self-discipline involving mental concentration and leading to mystic experiences or intuitions, techniques which will be described in a later chapter, whilst yogi is the person who practices such methods. Like the yellow-robed Indian yogis, I sat in trance, but later arose. First, to compose a chronicle of their lives and then to tell my Western brethren of the way to find and the worth of finding this mental quiet. Yet, when the intermittent satisfactions of mental peace entered into conflict with an innate, ever-inquiring rationalism, tremendous questions slowly became insistent. I perceived that although the little pool of light in which I walked had indeed grown wider, the area of darkness beyond it was as impenetrable as ever. Quite naturally, when thought, time and experience raised certain fundamental problems, I turned in the first hope of finding clear guidance to the Maharishi. It will be remembered, by readers of my book A Search in Secret India, that this is the name of the renowned South Indian yogi with whom I practiced meditation several years ago. But the guidance never came. I waited patiently in the hope that time might draw it out of him, but I waited in vain. Gradually it dawned upon me as this question of obtaining a higher knowledge than hitherto rose uppermost in my mind, that so far he had never instructed any other person in it. The reason slowly emerged as I pondered the matter. From my long friendship with him it was possible to gauge that primarily this was not his path and did not much interest him. His immense attainments lay in the realms of asceticism and meditation. He possessed a tremendous power of concentrating attention inwardly and losing himself in rapt trance, of sitting calm and unmoved like a tree. But with all the deep respect and affection I feel for him, it must be said that in his few attempts to explain philosophy he got out of his depth. The role of a teaching sage was not his forte because he was primarily a self-absorbed mystic. This explained why his open disdain for life's practical fulfillment in disinterested service of others had led to inevitable consequences of a disappointing kind in his immediate external environment. It was doubtless more than enough for himself and certainly for his adoring followers that he had perfected himself in indifference to worldly attractions and in the control of restless mind. He did not ask for more. The question of the significance of the universe in which he lived did not appear to trouble him. The question of the significance of the human being did trouble him, and he had found an answer which satisfied him. But this was the same answer which all mystics, whether in ancient Asia or medieval Christian Europe, had also found. Meditation on oneself was a necessary and admirable pursuit, but it did not constitute the entire activity which life was constantly asking of man. It was good, but it proved to be not enough. For the efflux of time had shown me the limitations of mystics, and more time showed that those limitations were accountable by the one-sidedness of their outlook and the incompleteness of their experience. The more I associated with them in every part of the world, the more I began to discern that their defects arose out of sheer shriveled complacency, the hidden superiority complex and the holier-than-thou attitude which they had unjustifiably adopted toward the rest of the world, and also out of the premature assumption of total knowledge of truth when what they had attained was only partial knowledge. The conclusion was finally forced on me that the perfection of human wisdom would never develop out of any mystical hermitage, and that only a synthetic complete culture could offer any hope for its unfoldment. Thus I gradually travelled a road of reflection which made me see that the Maharishi's classic formula for meditation, "Who am I?" which I discovered later was borrowed from certain old Sanskrit authors, was not enough, albeit admirably proper in its own place as a milestone on the way to wise self-mastery. For this reason I deemed it advisable some years ago to alter this formula, which I did when beyond yoga. Writing my more recent books, where I offer this seed for analytic meditation with the new variation, "What am I?" The difference between the two short initial words was a difference of only two letters on paper, but of a most important divergence of outlook in thought. The word "who" was a personal pronoun and form-fit inquiry for the mystic who was preoccupied with himself as an individual and separate entity, whereas the word "what" was an impersonal interrogative pronoun whose reference rose to a higher level. "Who am I?" was a question which emotionally presupposed that the ultimate I of man would prove to be a personal being, whereas "what am I?" rationally lifted the issue to scientific impersonal inquiry into the nature of that ultimate I. Not that the first formula need be abandoned. It was necessary and excellent in its place, but that place was for novices, whilst the further formula was for the use of those on a higher level. The passage of the last few years, with its widening comprehension consequent on incessant search and its gradual growth of unusual experience, did not permit me to rest satisfied even with this important development. The instructive episodes of daily living confronted me, with deepening disillusionment, with the limitations and deficiencies of mysticism and the intolerances and defects of mystics, from whom I did not even exclude myself, and the efforts to understand the problems that arose eventually brought me to see the insufficiency of even this expanded outlook. I saw that just as resigned religious faith in mere dogma was insufficient for the mystic, so his own intuitional feeling was insufficient for me now, and that intuition must be put in its proper place and not be expected to perform miracles. Both had been tested and found wanting.